Just a quick word for the podcast community or folks that might be listening to this particular talky bit from the table on podcast. You're going to notice some sonic unevenness in this particular podcast. We had a little technical problem when this happened in our gathering, and so I've had to re-record the first part of it, but partway through it sort of switches to the ambient sound of the environment we were in, which was quite echoey, but it is how it sounded. And given that what I was talking about was why God is better in surround sound, that the metaphor I was working with was a sonic one, I'm going to leave it uneven. And even if that produces a bit of a wrestle to listen to while you're driving down the highway or whatever, if you're in a noisy environment, I hope that that challenge is dealable, because it will be very much a part of this particular podcast. Not all of them, but this one. There are lots of churches out there that are pretty high tech. In fact, providing houses of worship, as the tech industry prefers to call them, with high tech gadgets is a rather big business. It's big enough that most larger companies in those industries either have a dedicated salesperson or even an entire department that just takes care of this realm. We at the table are not really on their radar. I don't say that by way of a negative comparison or a critique, but rather just to begin to set our stage for a bit larger work of the imagination. When you put a complex sound system into a space, or when you design and hang a lighting rig, or you put up projectors and screens, the stated rationale for that is often communication or impact. This kind of idea that we have this important message to get out, and we want to do that as effectively as possible, so, you know, bring on the reinforcements. And from many vantage points, it's not difficult to appreciate how frustrating it can be to not be able to see or hear whatever's going on when you're in a shared space environment. And we know what this is like at the table when we change spaces. We experience some aspects of this when we move into a space like this one, as you'll hear later in the podcast, a very reverberant space. When you can't see or hear well, it's harder to feel like you can really join in and participate. And that said, if we were to think about this a bit further, we might see that all of these things, the sound systems, the lighting rigs, the visual reinforcement technologies, they're all rather pale imitations of something much more remarkable and impactful. I spent more than a decade of my career working in this production area. I still dip into it on occasion. I can't tell you how many times I've heard someone talk about how great or how not great a PA system sounded using the analogy of transparency. If I was going to put it into non-technical terms, the sound system is really at its very best when it sounds like it isn't there. Like whatever is being presented sounds just like it would without a PA, but louder, so everyone in the room can hear it. And ideally, a PA would do that in such a way that the volume would be the same for everyone, rather than, you know, louder at the front and quieter at the back. It would sound what we would use a word like natural. We'd say it sounds natural. So, yeah, the bar for the systems we make is still the world out there, or the world in here, the world of our experience. And the gold standard is the world in which we live and move and have our being. When we use a term like virtual reality, we're giving a nod to this idea. Virtual reality is generally judged on how lifelike it is, not how virtual it is. And it seems that, generally speaking, what we deep down want is actual. We want the real thing. I believe that one of the most compelling features of the real world is the way that it surrounds us, the way that it can immerse us in experience. And as far as we can tell, it's been that way from the beginning. Now, here's the thing that the best science of the day and the first pages of the biblical collection have no quarrel about. And if you're listening on podcast, just be aware that this is where we switch to the ambient sound of the room. The world that we know, the one that surrounds us, this is going to sound kind of obvious, I'm going to say it anyways. The world that we know, the world that surrounds us, begins at the beginning.
And when I say that that's something that the best sciences of the day and the first pages of the biblical collection have no quarrel about, anybody who's kind of been in or around Christendom in the Western world for the last few hundred years might say, well, I don't think so. I think maybe there actually is a bit of a quarrel. But here's the agreed upon ground, if you will. In the beginning, something happened. Something unimaginably big and powerful and dramatic and fascinating. And whatever it was so outrageous in all those ways that if our puny attempts to grasp it have any merit, then it's still going on. It's still expanding outward. It's still exploding. Whatever that was, it's still traveling away from where we are. And so we use words and concepts like light, time, space, matter, motion, creation, evolution, you, me. We use these kinds of... What we're trying to do is put language around something enormous. And one way to think of these efforts is that we're trying to find entry points for what is, in our human experience, the ultimate creative act. We're trying to put language around that. And whether we picture that ultimately creative act as something that bursts or something that blooms or something that bangs into existence, whatever kind of metaphors or images or similes we use, what we're trying to do is we're trying to fathom something that is too big for words. But our words are what we have to work with. And we seem pretty motivated. And so we keep trying. Maybe it's that if we take the time and make the effort to look around, we're so astonished by the beauty and the wonder and the glory and the mystery of the world that we occupy that we can't stay silent. That's a possibility. We have to make something in response. And so we do. We make an idea. We make a poem. We make a song. We make a dinner. We make a culture. We make a baby. We make something. Response to one. I think that we do that because, at the risk of just offering another obvious sentence, I think we do it because we're alive. But when I wrote "alive" in my notes, it was all caps. And I'm not a shouter, even when I have a mic, but. We're alive, people. And the world that we're alive in is a wondrous, astonishing, remarkable place. In some ways, it's a confounding place because the things we do with our agency in the world are not always beautiful and good. But even when they're horrific, they're remarkable. And so we have this picture of being surrounded by a remarkable world. And one of the things that we tend to do as part of exploring and marveling and responding to our environment is we come up with concepts of how something so beyond us might have had its genesis. Genesis, of course, just means beginning. And over time, as we humans have laid on our backs looking at the stars, either with the aid of technology or without it, we've come away pondering possible images for what sort of energy or what sort of being or what sort of event could have provided the impetus to get a remarkable world like this into motion. And we've come up with lots of them over the history of humanity. And some of them are quite compelling. Most of the religious and mystic ones use some kind of creator language or images in response to that sense of wonder. And so I'm going to, rather than in the next few things that I want to kind of talk about here, I'm going to use creator as its own entire word. So rather than that representing an image of a superhuman of some sort, it just is. It's one word for all these possibilities, okay? Creator. When we think about the big themes, about the things we've cooked up to try to put language around this sense of wonder about the world that we're in, it kind of does fall out to a few different chunks. There's lots of nuance here to explore. You can spend your life on it. But some would suggest that Creator withdrew, that whatever this was that's responsible for this amazing world, that withdrew or contracted to make space for the universe to be. That's a picture of Creator that allows the universe, the place where we are, to sort of be on its own, to have its own life, its own being, its own history, if you want, to kind of have its own space. And again, language is going to fail on every one of these, so if that already felt like it failed for you, get ready, there's more. There's more failure coming. Some imagine Creator as making a kind of out there, what we would call time and space, and then filling time and space with galaxies and sort of inhabiting the galaxies like sound inhabits a space, like the way it reverberates around here, or the way light fills a space, or the way love fills a space. So for some people, that's kind of the imaginary picture of how Creator operates in all of this. Some picture Creator as making the universe within itself. So, in that picture, what happens is that the universe is in some way inside of its maker. It's part of its maker's own life and story. And that's very akin to the picture that I mentioned a couple of weeks ago of our human state being like that of a ship on the floor of the ocean, and the ocean being God or the divine. And there are, if we were to get particular about the Hebrew tradition in particular, which is where the biblical record of Genesis comes from, and in which it stands, some scholars would see the biblical Genesis story, which is in particular ancient wrestle with this question of how do we put language around this amazing world that we're in. Some would see that in those stories they would see an echo of ancient Middle Eastern temple dedication texts, which is kind of an interesting thought, because in the Genesis stories in the Bible, what happens if you see them as working with the template of ancient dedication texts for temples, what happens in those, when you lay that over top of the Genesis account in the Bible, is the whole universe becomes a temple, which is kind of a fascinating picture in terms of where the divine resides, if you want. And what happens in that picture is that Creator chooses to be represented by human beings in the temple rather than by manufactured things, spices, carved things, or what have you, by idols. Which is a complete aside, but I think deeply consistent with the biblical writings of Paul, where he goes way out of his way to make the point that the new temple is the human person, that the new home of the divine is us, is kind of central to Paul's teaching about some of these same ideas, which is interesting. So I think one of the things that's fascinating about that is how many different ways we find to try to imagine how the wonder of beginning might have happened. Just all these different vantage points, and that's just like three or four kind of big, broad stroke delineations of ways that us humans have thought about how do we account for beginning. It's almost as if as human beings we're running around in this unimaginably huge space, the universe. And those of you that are here for the first time this morning or who haven't been here that often, we've kind of been nibbling around the edges of this for a while. And a few weeks ago, Tim did this whole thing where he talked about Carl Sagan's little blue dot and a bunch of those pictures of the universe that start to actually give us some inkling of the size of the Earth in the wider scope of the heavens, of the universe. Anyway, so there's a bunch of stuff running in the background for people that have maybe been in this conversation at the table for a while, but when I try to imagine the human endeavor in this stuff, the picture that comes to mind is that as humans, we're just running around in this unimaginably huge space, and we're making noise. we're making noise wherever we go. And the reason we're making noise is because we want to surround ourselves with this story the same way that we find ourselves surrounded by the universe that we inhabit. It's like there's a, without even thinking about it, there's something in us that goes, we want to be inside the story, inside the narrative, the way that we are inside the universe. And however we imagine Creator to fit with all of this, whether that's about making something and standing back, whether that's about making something and flowing into it, whether that's about being and the thing that's made is inside the being, whatever the picture is, All of those pictures are us running around, making noise, trying to surround ourselves with a story that feels to us like the one we're living in. Did I make that clearer by talking about it more, or did I make it worse? If we could only do it transparently, if we could only do that in a way that was so like the thing that we're trying to describe, that the thing that we were making to represent the thing we're trying to describe sort of went away, and what we were left with was a fuller experience of the thing that we're making something about. That's a long, complicated sentence. And it references all that time I spent on the analogy of the PA system. If we could make the ultimate narrative about the human experience, it would be the human experience. It's like if you could make a perfect map, you'd have the thing that you made the map of. Right? The symbol would go away. We can't. But we can approach it. And that's what all these language things, all these things that we do when we're trying to talk about God, we're trying to talk about our human experience vis-a-vis God. That's what we're doing. Running around in the space that is the universe we inhabit, however we imagine it got here, making noise about it, in an attempt to surround ourselves with a story that feels like the experience we're having in the space. It seems like one of those things that we're fairly just moved to do as humans. As far as we can tell, we can track this back as far as we've been kind of making stories about things that matter to us or things that mystify us. So it's a big deal. If you put that way of thinking into the Genesis stories, one of the things you realize is that we can't make the thing itself. We can't make a story that is the thing itself. We can't do it. But we should keep trying, because in the trying, we are becoming. So what's happening is when we're making those stories, we are shaping story makers. We're shaping ourselves. And we're shaping ourselves in a way that has a huge impact on how we imagine the world that we're in. And how we imagine the world that we're in has an enormous impact on how we behave in the world that we're in. This is fascinating. And not, we're talking about it in a religious context this morning, because this is that kind of a gathering, but this is not necessarily, or even first of all, a religious enterprise. And if you ever wonder about the merit of that idea, just pay attention to the local cultural calendar. This Thursday, I think I've got the date right, is a beginning of a national conversation on Canadian values. Not a political conversation. This is carried forward by a non-political organization, a not-for-profit who's surveying Canadians and kind of trying to start this wider conversation about what are the Canadian values. I heard an interview with this guy this morning. One of the things that was fascinating about that interview is that he said, what we're intrigued by is not just to get a diverse take on what are the top values of Canadians, actually, by surveying Canadians, as opposed to going, I think we're going to screen people for Canadian values. Let's actually ask them what theirs are, and then let's start there. Not only that, but to say, how do you live out those values? So that's part of this organization's mission as well. I think that's super intriguing. It's not, not a religious enterprise. A cultural endeavor. You've already heard me say that I think the opinion that religion is a cultural artifact is entirely defensible, so we're just going to carry on from there. But that's interesting, isn't it? There's this human drive to do this. I think that matters. And we need to keep trying to do it, even though we know pretty much any time we stop and think about it, we can't make the thing that we're trying to tell stories about. We can't make that representation. We can't get there. But in trying, we're shaped, and in being shaped, we act. This matters. If we take this general line of thinking to the Genesis stories, we realize right away that what those stories say is pretty wild, because they have this sort of courageous, primitive imagination about them. No big surprise that we find it primitive, a word I use with care, because it doesn't mean lesser. It means older. All right. So one of the reasons we find them primitive is because they are. They're ancient stories. That we find them courageous might require paying some attention, because, and the reason I would use that word is because those stories dare to say, for example, that everything that we see and experience around us is an expression of the divine. One of the things that those ancient stories make abundantly clear. That's an outrageous thing to say, and it creates all sorts of problems. It also creates an enormous opening for fascination and exploration. I would say that the Genesis stories speak that way about the universe that we are in, that they regard it as the self-expression of the divine, because they picture the universe as a speech act of God. And I've talked before here about, if you just try to imagine an ancient person and their ancient picture of the cosmos and the divine, kind of going, how did this all get here? And then writing down a story where it all pours out of the mouth of the divine. Wow. Universe. That's a crazy, in a fascinating way, crazy picture. In other words, the Genesis stories in the biblical collection imagine that everything, everywhere is always an essentially spiritual, valuable, meaningful, holy, we can string other words in there. But those stories have the gall to imagine that the world we inhabit is like that. Those stories imagine a world in which matters. Stuff matters. So let's just stay in that space for a moment. If we were imagining the universe as the speech act of God, what language? What language might God use to speak the universe into being? I'm pretty sure that it wasn't English. What was it?
King James English.
Ah, old, the King's English, indeed. Therefore, let there be, so on and so forth. Yeah, like, absolutely. Yeah. Despite biblical scholarly opinion to the contrary, I still say that the guys who did that translation knew which side of their bread was buttered. And there's things about the translation that reflect that. Even, it might not have even been the King's English. If what happens as an act of imagination, what happens if we imagine God speaking the language of full spectrum light? Let's try that. There is nothing, contemporary science tells us, that is not made of light. We come from nothing more than light. And if it helps, if we're struggling with the idea that light is not material enough, it might help us to imagine the picture that we see with our eyes when we're in a room where the sun's coming in and there's dust in the air. We see these particles floating in the air. We see dust motes. And when we see the motes, we don't tend to think about light. But of course, the only reason we see them is because they provide a reflective surface for the light. The light's already there. Dust, the ancient poets in Genesis tell us, is what we're made of. Stardust, the astronomers of the 21st century tell us, is what we're made of. In other words, when we look at ourselves, what we see is the stuff that makes light visible to us. We are light. Everybody track that? For the ancient poets, working as they were without knowledge of things like cosmic dust, the larger things that generated and reflected light became their images of choice, right? They worked with what they could see. They worked with what they knew, just like we do. And how many years from now, I'm going to listen to this, should I have occasion, and go, really? Like, that was the best idea that I had? You know, this just keeps unfolding. But listen to this. So this is ancient poetry. This is part of the biblical collections from the Psalms. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day they pour forth speech. Night after night they reveal knowledge. They have no speech. They use no words. No sound is heard from them. Yet their voice goes out into all the earth. Their words to the ends of the world. Hear them making this ancient poet making the connections. Trying to make the connections. Running around in the space making noise. Telling a story. Going, how can we get this story to feel like it matches up to the unbelievable thing I'm seeing laying here on my back, looking at the sky. In the heavens, God has pitched a tent for the sun. It is like a bridegroom coming out of his chamber, like a champion rejoicing to run his course. It rises at one end of the heavens and makes a circuit to the other. Nothing is deprived of its warmth. You can hear the scientific limitations, right, in the poem. The sun, of course, does not make a circuit of the heavens any more than it behaves like a rested lover who's eager for some morning intimacy, right? But it doesn't matter, does it? Like, that's not the point, and so it's not the problem. The poet is in awe of the world around them. They are in awe of all of it. That's what's going on inside the poem. And they're doing the very best they can with what they have to evoke that sense of wonder, to gesture toward that sense of wonder, to remark on its goodness. They're running around in the space, making noise, making a story. Going, how can I make a big enough story with the words that I have? How can I make a big enough story with the knowledge that I have so that I feel like the story I'm in is the experience I'm having of the world? And what they have to work with is the art of the universe that they are surrounded by. If there's one refrain in Genesis, it's that this artful universe is good. Really, reading Genesis is a little bit, the early couple of chapters of Genesis, a little bit like listening to a pop song with a one-line chorus. Like, you don't really have to wonder what the song's about. It's good, it's good, it's good, it's good, it's good. By the end of it, but you get to the big chorus at the end. It's very good. The sky is dirt good. The dirt is good. The water's good. The animals are good. The humans are good. Like, it's good, 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 good. That's the refrain. I'm intrigued that in the Genesis poems, the very good is saved for the end. Maybe that's good songwriting. It's also, I think, more than a little nod in the direction of how good becomes very good when the pieces are working well together. Because that's what that particular refrain is saved for in those poems. You could, I think, legitimately understand that the very good is held in reserve for the moment in the poem where all the pieces are in place and where the whole thing is harmonious. All these good pieces, when they're playing well together, then it's very good. And somehow the poet has a sense that the human agency in that humming together is very important. And so the very good is held in abeyance almost, held back. We're waiting for it, we're waiting for it, we're waiting for it in the song, and then at the end, pow. If we consider the limitations of the song itself, of the poem itself, the very good can't possibly be on offer because the poet got it right. It just doesn't work. There's so many things not correct from the Western 21st century vantage point about the information in the poem. But the poem doesn't exist to convey information. The poem exists to convey wonder. The poem exists to remind us of the human endeavor of running around in this space, making noises, making ideas, making words, making pictures with our imagination, making pictures with our interactions, in an attempt to reflect the thing that we are immersed in. When the whole is more than the sum of the parts, then that's very good. So how do you make a PA system transparent? How do you surround people with sound in such a way that they can all hear without some being at an advantage and others having a lesser experience? Well, in theory, what you do is you essentially surround everyone with their own PA system. There is a room in Vegas, by the way. It's a designated theater space for the ongoing, long-running Beatles show there that has attempted this, technically. A fascinating sonic experience, because every chair in the room feels like you're in your own sonic space. So, an attempt. What happens, theoretically, to do this is that you surround everybody with sound in such a way that no one is being bludgeoned with volume from a single source or point. more on this next week, but from a visual vantage point, I think. We'll see. But what you do to accomplish this sonically is you take the original, this is assuming we have access to it, and you share it with each person in the room from multiple but individual vantage points. That's how you do that. That's how you make a PA system that sounds like it isn't there, but everyone can hear. How do you make a story transparent? Well, maybe the same sort of way. You share it from multiple vantage points so that everyone can have multiple ways of experiencing it. It's sort of like the way that we hear sound in an actual space. There's no way to create an immersive story experience with only one vantage point, any more than there's a way to create a transparent sonic experience with one vantage point. It just doesn't work. And I think that's instructive for us when we try to imagine our own version of how did we get here? How do we account for the world that we're in, for its wonder, for its mystery, for its power, for our unique place in it as a species? If I could say that there's one thing that I would hope for in the context of this community, which exists to explore what we believe, from a reflection like that, it would be that we would be able to dial down any distress we have when we encounter vantage points that come from other narratives than the one that we might be most familiar with, whatever one that is. It's not just okay. It's not just something to be tolerated. It's a way of attempting to approach storytelling a thing that is too big for any one story. This is essentially the message of Jesus when he shows up and keeps saying, well, you've heard it said, but I say. You know that story you thought had this whole divine human thing dialed? It's too small. Here's another one. And then when Jesus leaves the scene, he says, and by the way, the divine didn't go away, the divine is still here, and you're going to do more and greater than I've done. Keep telling the story. Keep finding another way to come at this. Because the thing you're talking about, the thing you're running around in the world making noise about, is way bigger than any individual narrative. So don't be afraid. Good, good, good. See if you can get the parts to play well together. Very good.